here. Now, one thing I want to let you know before we start, these three different statements in the gospel are in no ways contradiction. There is no contradiction in your Bible. The fact that Mark states it differently and Luke states it differently than is stated in the gospel of Matthew is in no sense a contradiction, because if you would look carefully at the context, you'd find that neither Mark nor Luke are dealing with what the Lord said as he spoke in the Sermon on the Mount. Neither of those passages or those contexts are dealing with the Sermon on the Mount at all. They're dealing with different times, which doesn't mean that the writers disagreed as to when the Lord spoke of this. It means the Lord used this metaphor more than once. That's all it means. Now, he did that, and I have used the word metaphor, and I'll explain that in a moment, but I want you to go back and reread verse number 13 of the fifth chapter of the book of Matthew. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing, but to be cast out and to be trodden underfoot. Now, so far as I can tell, the two pronouns it refer in one case to the earth, and in the second case to the salt. If you'll reread it, look at it. Ye are the salt of the earth. But if the salt hath lost his savor, wherewith shall it, that is the earth, be salted? It is thenceforth good for nothing. That it there refers to the salt. It is good for nothing but to be cast out and trodden under men's feet. The only alternative to that would be something to salt salt. And of course, that doesn't make much sense in the context, either in the practical application to it or in anything else. So I think he's saying, with wherewith shall the earth be salted. I'm quite sure of that. Now, our text is the first recorded metaphor used by the Lord in his teaching. What I'm saying is this. I'm not saying that he never used another one, but I'm saying, that he did not use one previous to this. But when we begin to look at the Lord's public ministry, we come to the fifth chapter of the Gospel of Matthew, the Sermon on the Mount, and so far as I can tell, we have the first metaphor where they recorded the use of a metaphor in the purpose of teaching or in the process of teaching. Now, this is a type of teaching that is perfectly suited for the teaching of plain people. Let me define the word. I think most of you know what it means. A metaphor is different than an illustration. It's different than a parable. A parable is, of course, a story that's told, not a tale of fiction necessary. It may be a true-to-life story. For instance, there was a certain man. I don't think it's a true-to-life story. I think it's dealing with a particular person. May even give their names. But in other cases, there may be a story told which would not necessarily need to be an accurate account of anything, of any particular instance, but it is a true-to-life situation that all of us would be familiar with. And a parable or a story is given to illustrate a doctrine or a truth. Now, the word metaphor is a word that refers not to a story or an illustration, but to an item that we're all familiar with. For instance, the Lord said, I am the vine. My Father is the husbandman. I am the vine. Ye are the branches. Now, all of those words are metaphors, and of course, the metaphor used there is the vine. He uses the grapevine, with which all of those people were familiar, in order to illustrate a relationship between himself, the Father, and the disciples, and the vine very clearly illustrates it once we get used to it. He uses that type of teaching many times throughout the Bible. It takes something that they understand. Now, we don't understand too much about salt today. I'll tell you some things about it. And I won't tell you all about it, but I'll tell you some things about it. Some of you folks would know. Some of you old-timers would know more about it than some of the young people because of the era of freezers and things that we have today. But in any case, the use of a metaphor is a very practical way of teaching. How many of you folks like to read after Charles Spurgeon? If you like to read after Spurgeon, I love to read after Charles Spurgeon. And he is a man who is very highly educated. You read his language. To me, some people don't like Spurgeon's language. I love to read Spurgeon because of the clarity and the definitive nature of the language that he uses. Sometimes, if you notice in some of his higher messages, he says, I want to be very simple. I want to be very plain. Sometimes he throws a word or a phrase out there, and you say, run that by me again and again and again. And it takes me about four or five times sometimes to soak it up because it's not. But Charles Spurgeon had a large, large series of teachings that were referred to as John Plowman's Talks. How many of you folks ever read John Plowman's Talks? And they are by Charles Spurgeon. And he uses such things as a story of a man shaving a pig, or a man riding a mule, or something of that sort. And he gets down to where the poor, plain people live. And he used those things to illustrate. That was sort of a parabolic type of teaching. But here we have a metaphor. It is a word. The word here is salt. And it is to illustrate a relationship. Now, our Lord used this form of teaching very, very commonly. He used it to describe, for instance, his adversaries. He said of the Pharisees, "You generation of vipers, you whited sepulchers." Now, you know what a viper is, and no man is a viper except in the sense of the of a metaphor. He's using the word to describe. No man is a sepulcher or a burial place, but he likened them to a burial place. He said, on the outside you appear good unto men, like the sepulcher that's painted white on the outside. On the inside it's full of dead men's bones. On the outside you look good. You're religious. On the inside you're full of hypocrisy and excess. And so he used metaphors to describe them. He used metaphors to describe his disciples. As I said, ye are the branches. He said to them in the following verse, from after the one tonight, you're the light of the world. He used metaphors to describe himself. He said, I am the bread of life. I am the water of life. I am the light of the world. If any man follow me, he will not walk in darkness. Many, many places he describes himself with a metaphorical teaching. And so this is very, very important as we begin to study the Lord's teachings, that we learn how to identify these metaphors, learn who he's speaking to, and learn what he's talking about. Now, the one thing that is necessary for a metaphor is that the people to whom the teacher speaks understand it. In other words, if I were to say to you folks tonight, some of you folks are like a worn-out wrist pin keeper. How many of you could draw me a picture of a wrist pin keeper? Brother Lester could. Anybody else that could in the house that can draw me a picture of a wrist pin keeper? How many of you know what a wrist pin is? Anybody out there besides Lester know what a wrist pin is? Isn't that amazing? A wrist pin is the thing that holds your rod to your piston in your car. Your wrist pin goes through there, fastens the rod to the piston, and the keeper's the thing that keeps the wrist pin from dragging against the sides of the cylinder as it goes up and down in there. So I know Lester knows that, and nobody else knew that. Some of you are just too modest to say. So it would be stupid of me if I were to try to build an illustration or show you. In other words, a wrist pin keeper is very important in a car. Take it out and throw it away, and you're going to have trouble before very long. I mean, you might go a while, but you're going to have trouble when that starts floating around in there and rubbing against the inside of your cylinder wall. Sooner or later, it's going to give you some problems, you see? And so, of course, sometimes now they have different types of keepers, but when they used to use the old keepers in there, I don't know if they even do that now. They may press them all in now. But in any event, if you got rid of that, it would be important. It is important. And we could show you folks out there how that we function like that, like parts of an engine. Well, if you don't know what a wrist pin keeper is, there are probably a lot of other parts of the engine that you could not identify. And so we could easily liken the people here in the church to various parts of an internal combustion engine. But if you didn't know anything about it, it wouldn't help. You wouldn't understand what I was talking about, would you? When the Apostle Paul likened the church at Corinth to a body, he didn't talk about the, the esophagus and duodenal portion in the stomach and various things. He didn't talk about those things. Why? Well, those people didn't know about those things. What did he talk about? Hands, eyes, ears, feet, things they were aware of, things they knew about. And so all metaphorical teaching deals with something that people know about. Now, the first thing we need to do in this, I believe, is to identify the salt. And this will be true throughout all of the Lord's parabolic or metaphorical teachings. We need to see who he's talking about, because the same thing won't apply to everybody. For instance, he was not saying to the Pharisees, "Ye are the salt of the earth." He wasn't saying to the Romans that may have been listening at a distance, if there were some there, "Ye are the salt of the earth." He was talking to a particular people. Verses 13, 12, 11, 10, and 1 clearly show us who he's talking to. The word "ye" is a pronoun, and of course when we use that pronoun, we always have to be referring to somebody that context identifies. For instance, if I were standing here looking at the wall, and I said, "You low-down, stinking, groveling, crawling little thing," you probably would think I was seeing a bug going up the side of the wall there, but I just used the pronoun "you." I might be talking about Brother Steve and having my back turned so he wouldn't know who I was talking about. See, no, that wouldn't be very good English, would it? That wouldn't make very much sense. The word "you" identifies somebody that has been the immediate context of a conversation or a statement that already precedes in this. And so if you look at verse 13, he says, "Ye are the salt of the earth." Verse 12, he says, "Rejoice and be glad, for great is your reward in heaven. Blessed are ye." Verse 11, "Blessed are they." Verse number 10, and verse number 1, "Seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was sent, his disciples came unto him, and he opened his mouth and taught them, as saying," and then we see him using the word "you," addressing the people to whom he's speaking. Nothing complex about that. So when you look at this term, "ye are the salt of the earth," know who he's talking to. He's talking to his true disciples. And actually, as we look at this, he uses a term that is to describe the value of this category of people. In other words, they were not the salt of the earth because of some particular virtue that was in them, but they were a category of people, that is, his disciples, and he uses this to define this particular people. You'd notice there is, in verse 1, a hypothetical placement of these people. What do I mean by that? Well, maybe not everybody that was out there in this congregation could be referred to as the salt of the earth. You say, "Well, preacher, why do you say that?" Because we find, for instance, over in chapter 8, "And from that time many of his disciples went back and walked no more with him. They said, 'This is a hard saying. Who can know it? We thought this man was the Messiah. He's an imposter. We don't want anything to do with him.' And they turned back to their Judaism or their Phariseeism. Were they the salt of the earth?" No. This is a hypothetical situation that in essence says, if ye are the poor in spirit, those that mourn, the meek, those that hunger and thirst for righteousness, the merciful, the pure in heart, the peacemakers, those which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, those who are reviled for my sake, if you are truly of that category of people, then you are the salt of the earth. Now, having, I trust, established who he's talking to, let's look at the second thing, and that is the attributes of salt which warranted the use of this metaphor. What is it about salt that made the Lord use this illustration? Now, these people were not actually salt. All of us are aware of that. The only person in the Bible that I know about being salt is Lot's wife. She turned to a pillar of salt. The rest of us, though we have a lot of salt in our body, we're not salt. Some of us are a little salty, but we're not salt in a literal sense. And yet he says, "Ye are the salt of the earth." And it was attributes of salt that caused him to use this metaphor. What are the attributes of salt that brought this about? Well, let me point out, first of all, that salt is a preservative. Now, you say, "Preacher, are you a postmillennialist? Do you believe that the people of the Lord are going to, going to evangelize the world, going to change the world for good?" No, I don't believe that at all. But I don't want to back up for one moment when I say that the Lord is stating here that there is a great preserving effect in this earth by his people. Now, when I was a child, we used to raise our own meat, never raise quite enough of it. We could always eat a lot more than we had. Well, actually, we couldn't. We always could eat exactly what we had, but we could have eaten. Speaking hypothetically, we could have eaten a great deal more had we have ever raised it. We usually managed to save back one ham for Christmas, and after that, we fasted and prayed till about the middle of March. before we got anything else to eat. But when we would kill the meat as soon as it got cold enough, but you know, you couldn't do it too soon because we didn't have a refrigerator. We didn't have an ice box. For years, you know, we called our refrigerator an ice box. Any of you folks still call your refrigerator an ice box? Some of you folks have never even seen an ice box, and most of you have never used one. But back then, we didn't even have an ice box. You know, anything that you kept, you had to keep it without refrigeration because we just didn't have it. In the summertime, you might take some cold water and put your milk in there to keep it from ruining too quickly and a few things like that. But you basically lived on things that did not take refrigeration. I was almost grown before I bought the first ice box for my mother and put in our house out of money I made at the school janitoring. Gave $10 for it. And 1 month's wages for an ice box. I don't know what I bought it for because we probably never put ice in it more than 100 times, maybe not that many, and all the times you had it, you couldn't afford the ice. Besides that, we lived 7 miles from town. You couldn't get anybody to come out and bring it out very much. But it was wonderful to have once in a while. It made a good cupboard, and that's about what she used it for. So things were very different then. Well, we'd kill the hogs, and you had to wait until it was cold enough to cure the meat. Now, once the meat got cured, if you got a warm spell, you were okay. But we would take this meat, and of course, when you kill the meat, you made sure that you had plenty of salt on hand. And then you take that and you just rub that salt into it. Rub that salt. You couldn't eat the stuff. It wasn't like some of this bacon. You could not possibly eat it like that. It had too much salt in it. It wasn't supposed to be eaten like that. Before you ate it, some of the ham, you could handle the ham all right. The bacon stuff like that, my mother would put it in water and soak it and wash the salt out of it. Ruby knows what I'm talking about. She's a country girl. Wash the salt out of it before you ate it. But I tell you what, you get that stuff well cured with that salt, and you could hang it out or hang it in, put it wherever you wanted to. And if it got cured all the way to the bone, And no worms got to hatching in it before you got there. It was good, man. It would go and go and go, and you could do about anything to it. I mean, you didn't have to keep it in refrigeration to haul it across the country. You could throw it out on the front porch. If the dogs didn't eat it, it'd be all right tomorrow. No problem at all. It cured it. Now, that we're talking about a preservative. This is a preserving effect. And I want to say this to you tonight. This world would self-destruct if it were not for the effect of Christianity upon it. Oh, I know that most of the world does not want what we have to offer, but they get a lot of it anyhow, in spite of everything they can do. You understand that every one of us are to some extent a product of society. Society around us has an effect upon us. Most of you folks are much more liberal in your living than you were 15 years ago. I would dare say all of us are much more liberal without intending to be. Even if we said, I ain't going to change one bit. They can take me out and hang me up by the toes and let the flies eat on my eyeballs, and I'm not going to change. I'll guarantee you, you'll change. You'll change. You do change. We are a product of society. Now, just as society tends to change us, we change the society. Have you ever been in the company of people who talked with vile language all the time? And sometimes they make you sick to your stomach. But have you ever been there and all of a sudden they said, I'm sorry, I forgot about you being here. And they tone it down. That's an effect. And those effects are scattered throughout the world. It's a good effect. Not the only thing we're talking about, but it is a preserving effect of Christian influence. Some years ago, a man, and I looked around to try to find, you know, I wish I had some way of filing in my mind where I knew how to find all of the illustrations that I'd ever read in my life, you know, but I don't know how to index them that completely. I could do it, but then it still wouldn't help because I wouldn't know where, you know, what thing I'd put them under. But nevertheless, this was a story I read some years ago of a man who had done some research on, extensive research on two families. One of the families was the offspring of Jonathan Edwards, and I think he went 6 generations. I'm not sure if it was 6, maybe 5, but he went 6 generations, and he took all of the offspring of that man, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren, and he took all of those, that offspring, and then he took another man who was who lived in that period of time, roughly, I'm not sure, it may have been Benedict Arnold, but it was some notorious ne'er-do-well. And he took their offspring, as far as he could trace it, and studied that. And he found this, that out of the family offspring of Jonathan Edwards, there were hundreds of ministers, doctors, lawyers, decent people. Out of this other man, there was this tremendous, tremendous number of criminals, a large number that had been executed for capital crimes. Now, I'm not dealing necessarily with the effect of just these people upon each other, but I'm talking about the effect of these people upon the world. What kind of an effect do people who love others, who help others, who are kind to others, who are decent toward others, what kind of an effect do they have upon the world as opposed to those who rape, murder, plunder, and abuse? You see the difference. There is a tremendous difference, and they have an effect in the world. Now, this is not evangelism yet. We'll get to that later. I'm not talking about evangelism. I'm talking about the social and the economical effects that Christianity has upon the world. They are tremendous, tremendous social and economical effects. Not only is salt a preservative, salt is a seasoning. Much or most food is absolutely not fit to eat without it. Now you say, well, I eat a lot of things without salt. You eat almost nothing without salt. You take any vegetable you've grown in your garden, almost anything you can find, and have it analyzed, and there's some salt in it. There is some salt in it. You follow what I'm talking about? Now, what I'm saying is simply this, that this world would be a terrible place to live if it were not for Christian influence. A lot of people that don't want to be Christians, they're not interested in the church. They would not defend your right to be a Christian. They would not even admit that you are a Christian. They might call you a hypocrite, a show-off, a fanatic, and all of it. But I want to tell you something. They live in a better world because you live there. You got me? Their world that they live in is seasoned. It is made a better place to live because you're there as a Christian. As a Christian, it's a better place to live. My father used to tell the story of a doctor, and I've heard his name. I don't know it anymore. That was for some time in our little town. Of course, I didn't live in town. I was a foreigner. I lived 7 miles out in the country. And when I was little, we went to town once a week. I mean, once a year. The children went to town once a year. My father went once a week, but we went once a year, and that was a big day for us. I remember we would just, you know, get together and go to town in the wagon, and, man, we'd just walk up and down the streets and look at all those things. I bet everybody looked at that. Everybody got a show, you know. We were so ignorant, so poverty-stricken and everything. I'm serious about that. I'm not joking. I'm dead serious about it. But my father used to tell the story of a doctor there in that city who claimed to be an atheist. He was a self-acclaimed atheist, that he didn't believe in God. But every Christmas, he gave a nice donation. I think back then, maybe it was $100, which would be equivalent to several thousand dollars now, to all of the churches in that little town, probably 8, 10, maybe 12 churches in the little town, and he gave a sizable donation to all of them. His wife and daughter attended one some, but he gave a sizable donation to all the churches. And my father said, why is it you don't support one instead of giving money to all of them? He said, I don't believe in any of them. And he said, then why is it that you help to support them? He said, because of the good effect that they have on the society in which my family lives. Well, now at least this man had enough sense to see that these things do have a good effect. They do indeed. Christian people have a good effect upon the society around us. Not only is salt a preservative and a seasoning, but salt is an essential mineral. It is an essential mineral. You can't live without it. I mean, you can't. I don't know if any of you folks have ever worked with livestock or not, but if you, even the old ranchers, go back 100 years ago, and the old ranchers who didn't have an area of a salt lick on their farm knew that they had to get salt to their cattle. Their cattle would die without it. They could not properly digest the other food in the roughage. They had to have the salt. It was necessary. They'd do about anything to get salt to their cattle. When I was a child, we did that. We had to, I mean, we might be hurting for certain, but if we had an old cow out there, we knew that in due time she had to have some salt. If you didn't, before long, she wouldn't eat right. She'd look terrible. It is an essential mineral. This idea of a salt-free diet is a misnomer. Now, we probably use too much salt, and the doctor says, don't add salt. But he never has you say, get somebody to take all the salt out of your green beans that you grow out in the garden. Most of you who grow a garden, I know Brother Larry Burrell have probably seen this. I can frequently see it. But if we get a lot of rain, and I'm not able to get out there after I've worked in the garden and get a lot of rain, first thing you know, the top of your ground begins to turn white. You'll have some growing problems. You know what that is on top of your ground? It's salt. There's salt in all of that soil out there. Everywhere you go, there is salt in the ground. You can go to the North Canadian River, where near where I was raised. It's salty water. Where's that salt come from? Well, it's not a salt lick off up there somewhere in the panhandle that this river happens to run through. It picks up salt all the way down, everywhere you go. Now, you may have some very salty streams because they run through land where there's a greater concentration of salt. But all of the earth everywhere has some salt. While too much salt sterilizes, in other words, you can take anything and just sow it in salt, it won't grow anything. I mean, you can go out, well, all of you know that. You can take just salt water out of an ice cream freezer and take it out and dump it on your lawn in one spot, and you know what will happen. Your lawn will turn brown for a while. It'll kill the grass. It can't stand it. It'll sterilize the land. It'll kill the foliage that's on it, and sometimes nothing will grow there. If you put enough salt there, nothing will grow for a long time. On the other hand, all land must have some salt in it. Every time that you take a commercial fertilizer, for instance, and add to your land, did you know it has salt in it? Every one of those, one of the main products in that is salt. Sodium nitrate, for instance, you have sodium nitrate. Sodium is salt. And it is something that's an essential mineral, and that's why the Lord uses this metaphor. He says this world must have Christian people. You search the world for a worthwhile society. Now listen to me. For a worthwhile society built outside of Christianity. Look it over. Check it out. I realize that we have, for instance, the economic advances and perhaps in some senses even superior advances of Japan in economy today. But I'll tell you something, the effect of Christianity in Japan is very widespread today. And you can go to other portions of the world where we've seen the same thing taking place, and you'll see that the effect of Christianity is very widespread there. But go to India. Among the Buddhists, among the Hindus, among the people there who have never practiced Christianity, and see what the state of those people will be. Go to Ethiopia. Look at Ethiopia. While they had nominal, though it was very poor and very ignorant, while they had nominal Christianity there as compared to what it is now. Go to Africa, they say the cradle of the world. You look over there, and you know you have these dingbats that are raising Cain about the terrible, terrible, terrible abuses that South Africa is heaping upon the black people. But I want to tell you a secret. Black people are doing everything they can do to get into South Africa. All of the countries around South Africa, most of the people there would give anything if they could get into South Africa and get in on some of the benefits of even, yes, abusive, sure. You say, well, you mean you think that the Dutch or the English never take advantage of the blacks? Well, let me tell you something. Men will take advantage of men anywhere they can. They always have. They always do. That's human nature. That's bad. But I want to tell you something, that the effect of Christianity there. You say, well, I heard those people were mean to the blacks. You go see how the Zulus treated each other. You go back and learn how the blacks treated you. You go wherever you want to in this world where Christianity is not there, and you're going to understand that they have a tremendous social effect upon people in that sense. Let's go ahead. Thirdly, let's look at the warning about savorless salt. Now, men are not salt. You're not salt. That's only a descriptive metaphor. Men are not fig trees. Salt is a mineral, doesn't grow anything, it's like a rock. A fig tree is an inanimate, but a living object, and you know, it has life. But we're not even in that inanimate thing. We are people with knowledge, with understanding, with responsibility, and the Lord is warning here maintain your savor. Maintain your savor. If you don't, you're in trouble. If you don't maintain your savor, the earth is in trouble. It's very necessary. Both you and the earth are in trouble if you don't do it. In other words, there is no other source for the world to be seasoned. Ye are the salt of the earth. If the salt hath lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? Now, what was the answer that the Lord was supposing there? He didn't give the answer. The answer was so understood that it was supposed that everybody would understand that he was saying this, that if Christian people, if the Lord's disciples do not have the savor that the salt of the earth is supposed to have, what's the earth going to do? Nothing it can do. You are that preserving factor. The earth is in trouble without that. Not only that, but he gives a warning there that we're not good for anything in this world if we don't have that influence. Have you ever heard people talk back and forth about eternal security and how wise it would be, you know, if one person says, you know, if I believed in falling from grace, that when a person got saved, I just blow their brains out and send them on to heaven, you know, before they lost it. And I guess that's logical enough. You know, if you believe they were going to die and go to hell tomorrow, you'd be doing them a great favor to kill them, get them into heaven today. On the other hand, other people say, well, you know, if we didn't have some persevering to do, if we didn't have to do this or that, that God wouldn't let us live after we were saved. But you see, this explains why God leaves Christian people upon the earth. A preacher said some years ago that he had a church member who said to him, preacher, why? He said he was a strong Christian, a hard worker, a good, godly man. And he said, preacher, why can't I get a job where there are some Christians? Why can't I get a job where I can talk to Christian people? How come I have to be among all of these people that swear and cheat and lie and tell dirty and filthy jokes? And he said, that's where God put you, to do something. Ye are the salt of the earth. God has a purpose. Listen to me. You may not think you have a lot of effect where you work. You have an effect if you're a Christian. And the illustration that follows this, the lights of the world, is relevant to this. But the Lord is saying, you are the salt of the earth. The earth has no hope without you. And you have no value unless you do what you're supposed to do. See what he's saying? Both things. In other words, you're good for nothing but to be thrown out and trampled under the foot of man. The earth will not be salted if the Christian people have lost their savor or their saltiness. The earth will not be salted and you won't be good for anything. Now, we not only should, but we shall be trampled. You hear me? If we abandon that saltiness, if we do not maintain that savor, if we do not trim our lamps and keep our lights burning, if we do not maintain ourselves, not only do we deserve to be trampled under the feet of men, but we shall be trampled under the foot of men. When was Peter trampled underfoot? I mean, you think about this man. He was a pretty outspoken fellow. He went out into the garden that night. He drew his sword, cut off the ear of the servant of the high priest. The Lord rebuked him and put the ear back on, but Peter was not trampled underfoot there. I mean, brother, I imagine at that moment that he stood as an example of bravery that every one of those disciples would have liked to have said, boy, I wish I'd had the guts to do what Peter did. Oh, yes, I know he made a mistake, in the Lord, but I wish I'd had the guts to do it. I don't think there's any person that wouldn't say, I wish I had that kind of guts. Have you ever seen someone stick their neck out an area of Christianity and said, well, I thought they were a little bit too forward. I thought they were a little bit obnoxious. But I tell you one thing, I appreciate their courage. You've seen that, haven't you? And Peter was trampled underfoot. When? When he was afraid to stand. When he was later on embarrassed. That's when he was trampled underfoot. And beloved, that's exactly when we will be. He says we'll be trampled under the foot of man. Listen, we have endowments and we are responsible to use them every day in every way we can. And I don't have time to get into all of those things, but all of our personal resources and assets are endowments that God has given us to use in this world, to change the world in which we live, in our influence in the world. Every one of you, there's not a person here tonight, not even a little five-year-old school child, who does not have some influence in this world. All of us have. You children who are here tonight that are Christians, you have some influence in the world. Now, you can be a little knothead that runs along and follows the crowd, and you still have influence. Even though you may be a follower, you still have an influence. Or you can be a person that says no to evil temptations and evil dares and things of that sort, and you'll have an influence. Every man, every woman, every person here tonight has some influence in this world. Not only that, but beloved, we need to be very careful as far as realizing the importance of the saltiness of the Christian in this world, to do all we can to get our children to perpetuate. You're not going to be around to shake the shaker very long, folks. All of us are going to be gone sooner or later. And one of the things that we ought to pray for every day is that somehow we will be able to leave an influence with our children that will ultimately cause them to follow the Lord and carry on the effect in this world that we have carried on. You know, humanism today is doing everything they can to forbid us to pass this on to our children. They said, don't try to influence your children. They even try to get laws passed to say, you've got to be careful. You can't influence your children. Your children are ward of the state. You can't get them to believe certain religions. Leave them alone. Let them come to their own convictions. Garbage. Pure garbage. Don't be fool enough to fall for that slop. Now, I understand. I know that only God can bear a soul into the kingdom of God. I know that you cannot save your children. I understand that. I understand that you cannot train your children into salvation. You can't make them children of God by simply teaching them the things of God. God has to save them. I understand all of that. But I understand something else along this line. That we need to do all we can from the time they are little babies to promote Christian principles. And even, let me say this, even if your children are not Christian, they can have this salting effect through you by the things you teach them. Be careful that we do all we can. I don't have time to stay longer on that subject, though there's a lot more to be said. I want to just close this evening by summarizing some applications that this has for us. First of all, if we are His disciples, we have certain inescapable responsibility. Ye are the salt of the earth. Are you His disciple? If you are, then God has ordained for us these particular responsibilities, and there is no other way for them to be done. Now, let me say it again. I didn't say that well. Because God has ordained it for us, let me say it that way, there's no other way for it to be done. Now, that's what He says. If the salt hath lost its savor, ye are the salt of the earth. Not everybody, not just somebody. If you don't do it, there's nobody to replace you. That's what He's saying. Ye are the salt of the earth. And if the salt have lost its savor, wherewith shall it be salted? Wherewith shall the earth have this influence? And so we have an inescapable responsibility. It's not going to be done any other way. And then let me say this. Christianity is a formidable power when we do things His way. I want to show you something. The Jews, from the time of Nebuchadnezzar and following, invariably had men who were trying to defeat the anti-Semitism movements of the world and all of those who were against Jehovah God. For instance, one of the disciples was given a name I can't remember. The term that went with his name. I'll think of it tomorrow morning, first thing. Sorry, I apologize. But anyhow, what it meant was that he was a militant anti-occupation person. In other words, he wanted the Jewish people to be free of Greece. If he lived in that era of time, he wanted them to be free of Rome. If they lived in that era of time, he invariably was militant in that way, and he was trying to get people together and say, let's liberate ourselves. Listen, there were Jews dying for that continually. That's one of the things that Christ was accused of, as being an insurrectionist and trying to press in that direction. There were movements of all kinds continually. Did you know something? About all any of them ever managed to do was to get a bunch of Jews killed. That's the reason Jerusalem was destroyed. Went down in utter defeat. But you know, the Christians did something else. Now listen to me. They were taken into prison. They were eaten by lions. They were gored to death by bulls. How would you feel about having your wife or your daughter stripped naked and put out into a coliseum to be gored to death by a bull while you were tied and forced to watch? That's what they did with Christians. The Romans did that. The Romans took Christians, Nero took Christians, and had them dipped in tar alive. And they lit the tar and used it to light his gardens at night for parties. You say the salt of the earth? Yeah. And people who followed Christ, even in their pain and persecution, that they turned the direction of the Roman government. And Rome rotted from the inside, but they went down as pacifists. You follow what I'm talking about? And one of the great eroding effects to that harsh government was the effect of Christianity upon them in that day. Yes, Christian people are the salt of the earth. Now, this was not evangelism. Please don't misunderstand. The effect that the Christian people had on the Roman Empire was not evangelism. Roman Catholic Church was never the Lord's Church, and their evangelism was never evangelism. It was always militant. They went in, for instance, to South America, said, "Become Christians or we'll kill you. Which you prefer?" A lot of the people took Christianity, a lot of them took death. And I know a lot of you folks don't realize that Cortez was a missionary to South America. He really was, as far as the Catholic government or the Catholic Church is concerned. He was a missionary. He killed thousands, tens of thousands of people. Of Milton Martin, a missionary friend of mine, showed me once when I was in Mexico. He said, "I want to fly over and show you here." He said, "Here's a chasm deeper than the Grand Canyon." And he said, I believe he said, 10,000 Mexicans jumped off of that cliff one day to keep from becoming Christians. And this was the effect of Cortez, the great missionary. Now, that's what Catholicism was, but the point is this, that Christian conduct in the midst of this government that was perhaps the harshest, the legs of iron, the strongest physical part of all of that Antichrist government that came down through that period of time, seen by Daniel, the strongest part of all of it, was seasoned, was touched, was eroded by the effect of Christianity. You have no idea. Oh, listen, our country has problems. Boy, it has problems. Amen? But it's still the greatest country in the world. Well, I hear somebody, I don't mind saying our country has problems, but if you say it to me, you be careful how you say it. Because I don't want you insulting my country, and I'll get mad and get in your eyes before you can hardly say don't do it. I don't like that, because I love our country. It has problems, but I want to tell you something. The greatest positive effect upon this country is because of those few Christian people who will walk with the Lord. Ye are the salt of the earth.